Welcome to another episode of Know Your Ombud. This is a series of conversations aimed to help you, as a consumer of financial services, understand your rights and where to go if you are not treated fairly. The financial ombud schemes include the National Financial Ombud, the FASE Ombud, the JSE Ombud, and the Pension Funds Adjudicator, which are all overseen by the Ombud Council. Lodging a complaint with an ombud is free and you do not have to have a lawyer. Let's be honest, there is not much in life that you can get for free. In each episode, we speak to one of the ombuds to understand the cases they deal with and how the ombud adjudicates complaints. We examine cases where the ombud has ruled in favor of the consumer and those that go in favor of the financial institution. This helps to explain our rights and responsibilities. Today, we are speaking to John Simpson, the FASE Ombud, which looks at the complaints related to financial advice. It is a particularly important ombud who has wide-ranging powers. So, welcome, John.
Thank you.
I'm really thrilled to have you on here, and we're going to unpack quite a lot of the work that you do. And I was saying just before we went on to be interviewed that I'm really impressed with the work that's been coming out of your office.
So just great. Kudos. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So kudos to you. But let's start by explaining to our listeners and our viewers, what type of complaints come to you? When should someone come to the FASE Ombud?
Well, look, as a general approach, any one of the ombudsman offices can redirect a call or can redirect the complainant to the right ombudsman office. So I wouldn't worry too much about worrying which office I must go to. If you're a complainant, if you have an issue with the financial industry or a financial institution, phone any ombudsman office. They'll direct you to explain what the problem is and they'll direct you to the right one. But in our context, what we deal with is complaints against financial advisors. So you would have, for example, a financial advisor that sells you a short-term insurance policy sold by a large insurer. Then if there's an issue with the advisor's advice and the advice that they gave you, or whether they didn't comply with all their duties in terms of the code, you can bring that complaint to us. We also deal with funeral policy claims. So there are a number of thousands of funeral policy providers that are not with the NFO, for example. They fall under our jurisdiction and we can deal with complaints against those providers. So that's the basic jurisdiction.
And what I really love about the new structure of the National Financial Ombud, although you currently don't sit directly under it, is this idea that you as a consumer don't have to try and understand who do I go to, who do I speak to, whether you phone the NFO or phone the FASE Ombud, you will look at it, the officers will look at it and say, this is the issue with the case. Because I think things can get complicated. It's like, is this, I'm not happy with my insurance product. Is it the product that's the problem or the advice? And that is determined by the NFO or yourselves. And I think that has simplified the process a lot for me. But obviously, one of the more obvious ones is around financial advice on investments and things like that, which we'll unpack. But I wanted to go since you've come into the office, you've implemented some quite new sort of measures. And one of them was the premature complaints process. And you also identified vulnerable complainants, which has helped, I think, speed up the process. But what is a premature complaints process exactly?
Well, look, most of the ombudsmen throughout the world have that process in place. Unfortunately, my office didn't have it in place. And I realized, okay, we had to quickly put it in place. And from there, it's been an enormous success. So essentially what it is a complaint. You get many complainants who report a complaint to our office, but have never actually lodged a proper complaint with their service provider. So they'll have an issue that arose. They might have made a phone call or something like that, but it wasn't sorted out. Now they immediately complain to us. What happens within cases like those is we ask the complainant to record it properly, to phrase it properly. We'll then send it directly to the service provider and say, right, here's a complaint. You haven't seen it yet. So deal with this complaint. You have 6 weeks to resolve it. If it's not resolved after 6 weeks, then we'll take it on and investigate it. So that's the premature complaints process. Something that comes in that hasn't been looked at by the service provider yet, and we want to give them a chance to first sort it out.
And do you find that in many cases that gets resolved, doesn't have to come back to you, and that just takes a lot of your plate.
Totally. It was a game changer for my office, certainly. You know, in the beginning, the things would just flow straight through to investigation, get stuck there because there's so many cases, so many priorities. So it would take a long, long, much longer time to resolve the things. Now, with a premature complaints process, your simple, valid, straightforward complaints and claims that should be settled quickly get sorted out within a minimum of 6 weeks. Get sorted out.
And I love the fact, I didn't realize that you actually help the consumer compile that complaint back to the
yes.
to the provider, because I think that's often it. You know, you phone, you say, I've got this issue. Oh no, go to the service provider. And for many consumers, especially in a country with lower financial literacy levels, that's hard for people. They just don't really understand what that means. So I didn't realize that actually also involved assisting them in compiling the complaint to the service provider. So that's really interesting. And I also mentioned the vulnerable complainant. What is a vulnerable complainant?
Well, look, it's a worldwide movement, obviously. You have vulnerable complainants throughout the world who have some other challenge that makes it more difficult for them to communicate or to resolve their complaint with financial institutions or even an ombud office. So what we did was we introduced a policy under the guidance of the Ombud Council. They suggested we implement a policy or create a policy of that nature. We then obtained information from the NFO as to how they deal with theirs. We then implement a vulnerable consumer policy. It's dynamic, not static. So you implement certain measures, but it can change over time, depending on the circumstances. The way we implement it is to look at what do we regard as vulnerable consumers. From our perspective, it was people over 65. It was people who are not financially literate or have major challenges in reading and interpreting documentation. It was people who had physical disabilities, like being hearing impaired or sight impaired. And it was also people who had, for example, in a single event, lost their entire life savings, for example. So those people were regarded as vulnerable consumers, and we classify them on our system. As soon as they're classified as a vulnerable consumer, we take extra measures to try and assist them. So if it's an elderly consumer, we're going to try and assist them quicker. Tell the service provider, listen, this is a vulnerable consumer. Please get the response to us quickly. See if you can sort it out quickly. For the physical disability type of complainants, we will obviously, instead of telling them, write to us, we'll call them and explain the problem to us, explain to us what happened. So those are the ways in which we try and assist vulnerable consumers. Yeah.
I have to tell you, John, I think there's some financial service providers who could learn from that. You know, I mentioned right at the beginning that you know, as a financial consumer journalist, I've seen a big shift in the phase ombud since you came into the office. But one of the big shifts that I've seen is you look very differently at advice now. You look and say, what would a consumer reasonably be expected to understand? And you actually put the onus on the advisor to highlight unusual clauses. And I want to use, there were actually two cases that came out of rulings that came out of your office, which related to tracking devices, which I found very, very interesting. Mm. So just for our listeners, there was a Toyota Hilux was stolen whilst on holiday. The insurer, it was obviously stolen. The insurer added an additional 45,000 rand theft excess because the vehicle was supposed to be fitted with a tracker. There was also Land Cruiser had a very similar case. Why do you think it was up to the advisor, not the consumer, to know this?
Well, look, from our perspective, there's two elements to these cases. The first element is when you buy a vehicle and the insurer immediately requires a tracking device to be installed, otherwise you're not covered for theft or hijacking, for example. So there the onus is immediately on the reasonable advisor to advise the client. Listen, you have a certain time period after buying this car to have a tracker installed, or if you don't do it, you won't be covered. And it must be very clear and explicit. It mustn't be some sort of guessing game as to whether it was conveyed or not. The code requires the advisor to give this advice because it's very material, very important. Give this advice to the consumer and also follow up to see, did they actually do it? You can't just advise and then just leave it, depending on the circumstances. So that's the one scenario. Buying a brand new car requires a tracker. The other scenario, which is more predominantly one we've been dealing with for the last few years, is a new requirement that came in. So you'll get lots of people who bought vehicles years ago now, and no tracker was required, or a single tracker was required, for example. Now suddenly the insurers realize there's a lot of high-risk vehicles that are being stolen commonly on our roads or in malls or wherever that it may be. And then they insisted on new conditions. For example, now it's a high-risk vehicle, the tracker must be installed, or a second type of satellite tracking device must be installed. Now, this is a new requirement that came in that the insurers imposed. The advisor's duty there is very clear. Tell your client, this is a new requirement, it's material. If you don't have it installed, you won't have cover. And we found a number of cases where the advisor simply sent a generic letter to all his clients to say, listen, new measures have come into place. Just check whether yours isn't a high-risk vehicle and you might have to install a tracker. Something generic, very non-descriptive, non-specific, just a general template that went up. We said, no, that is not acceptable. A reasonable advisor would most certainly identify the specific client who's affected, inform them specifically of the requirement, and where necessary, actually follow up to check, did they install it? That would be the standard reasonable advisor in terms of the code and in law, in our view, and that's the conditions we imposed, and we held advisors liable for not informing their clients properly.
And I think the advisor had to pay that excess that insurer...
Well, in that particular case, the advisor was actually lucky because the insurer actually paid predominantly the value of the claim. It was just an excess they didn't pay. In most cases, the insurer pays nothing. If the tracker hasn't been installed, zero cover, zero payment. And we have made orders in cases where no payment of any kind was made, and the advisor was liable, for example, 800,000 rand.
I mean, that's quite a big... I imagine advisors are not thrilled with you right now. But the other part of it is that, you know, if you use an advisor, you pay for that advice.
You do.
And I think there's a lot of advisors that sometimes forget that part. It's that sort of, and this is always, of course, my consumer hat on, when you are paying for advice, that is exactly what you should get. And you should get the advice that you've paid for. And what you're saying is, if you're going to charge somebody an advice fee, then you're going to be held to the code of conduct.
Most certainly. I mean, look, the simple nature of it is you're paying for a professional service to be delivered. A professional service requires a level of professionality and care and diligence that you would expect from a professional. Just passing on documents or being a postbox or not worrying too much about this, that's not what a professional does. So that's the standard we require. And look, I just want to put it in context. Obviously, the cases that we receive is where a problem occurred or where an advisor didn't do what they were supposed to. But if you put it into the context of the millions of financial transactions that take place every day, insurance policies that are sold every day, the percentage of complaints we actually receive where a problem has occurred is pretty small. So, you know, I'm going to definitely put in context that it's certainly not all advisors, but obviously when problems arise, or when the advisor's not doing what they're supposed to and a problem arises, we're there to obviously sort it out.
I wonder if it isn't actually also good for advisors, this kind of proactive sort of action by the FASE Ombud, because now when somebody, because you know people can buy direct insurance, right? So you go direct, you're not going to have this protection.
Yes.
Whereas if you use a financial advisor, you have the protection of the FASE Ombud, and I think that, you know, that is actually helping advisors. I think it elevates advice to that level that I think many advisors would like to be seen and recognized, that what they do is they do add value. So I think that to me it goes both ways on that one.
Certainly.
But another case that was very interesting to me, also very similar in the sense of it was around advice or advice not given, was an Uber driver. So this chap buys a car. He then decides he's going to use it to be an Uber driver. He phones his insurer. He does the right thing. This is key. He phones his broker and he says, I am going to be using this. I need to change to business insurance. Changes to business insurance. He's in an accident and the insurer says, no, we don't cover you because Uber driver is commercial, not business. Another interesting case.
Yeah, look, again, it's professionality of the issue that arises, or the advisor's advice. Obviously, in our view, the reasonable advisor knows exactly the difference between commercial insurance or a commercial policy and a business policy, what the requirements are. And the code, again, also says the advisor must understand and obtain information directly about what the consumer's needs are and what is the best product for his needs, that meets his needs. And in this case, it was clear. The advisor had, even if the consumer had said, no, I want business, the consumer's not the expert in the area. He's under the impression he needs business insurance, but the advisor is the professional and the expert and will know, what is it you want to use the car for? No, that's not the policy you need commercial. So on that basis, we held the advisor responsible.
It's a very interesting case as well, because I must be honest, I don't know if I would have known the difference between business and commercial.
And you're not expected to.
And I'm not expected to. But if I'm paying someone for advice, they're
exactly
expected to.
They're expected. And if they don't know, they must find out.
We've been talking a little bit about, most of these have actually covered short-term insurance and advice on short-term insurance, should I say, put that case. But this one talks more to investments. And this one really, I found very interesting, this determination. Well, not determination, it was ruling. There was a woman who went to her financial advisor and said, I want to withdraw 500,000 Rand from my pension preservation fund. Now, it's very important just to understand that you only can withdraw once from a pension preservation fund before retirement. Okay, so this was her one-off withdrawal that she was going to be allowed. And she said, I need 500,000. And her advisor said there would be no tax deducted because he had misread the tax tables. So when she got the payment, it was less 885,000 Rand because tax had to be paid. And you found that the advisor was liable.
Yes. No, there's no question of that in our minds. You know, when you look at a situation like this, again, it's the professional advice. This person needed a specific amount and needed specific advice on withdrawing it. The advice was given. The advice was totally incorrect. And I'm sorry, you can't hide behind wrong advice. If you give the incorrect advice, it leads to a loss, which in this instance it did, you are liable to repay. So we made the recommendation that the advisor repay the difference in terms of the tax that she had to pay, and they paid it. So yeah, that's another example of that situation. But one thing I just wanted to sort of raise at this juncture is how to avoid problems like that. And look, all the cases you've been explaining, certainly all in favor of the complainants and against the advisor, certainly. But there are a lot of cases where the complainant or the client or the consumer could have avoided the problem from the start, never an issue, just by a simple Google search, for example. So in that instance, for example, with the tax tables, a simple Google search, if I withdraw 500,000 from my pension fund, is it taxable? AI or any answer probably would have immediately popped up, yes. From there, immediately your yes would have gone, okay, but wait, then the information I'm getting is not accurate. That would lead to further questions. So from my point of view, and that's something I've been trying to get across to consumers wherever I possibly can, just read something, and you don't have to spend hours doing it. Google search it. It'll quickly give you a few tips and a few just broad points that you can just ask the advisor, but what about this? What about that? You can avoid a problem from the beginning by just doing something simple like that.
So John, really what you're saying is consumers need to actually educate themselves. I mean, I'm completely on your side on this one, because obviously that's a lot of the work I do, a lot of the work that journalists do as well, is to say, and I always say, I'm not trying to give people financial advice. I'm not allowed to do that, but I'm giving you the questions you need to be asking.
Exactly.
And I think you're right. I think as consumers, we also need to at least have some level of our own financial understanding so that when we're engaging with somebody, we have some idea of what we should be asking and perhaps what that information should be. And I do agree with you. Obviously, the financial advisor needs to know you know, know their stuff, right? But you do protect yourself by having a little bit of knowledge. So please read my columns. That's the main reason I'm punting myself. Not you, the consumer needs. Hopefully, John, you don't need to read my columns. But, you know, you've been talking about the onus on the consumer. And yes, I've raised the cases where the ombud is ruled in favor of the consumer because I think it's important that people recognize the ombud's there for them. Mm. But there are, of course, many cases where you do not rule in favor of the consumer. And the one that I was looking at was this forex trading complaint. Mm. You must get so many of these.
We do.
You do.
Quite a few.
And this is the difference. It's like this guy gets a call inviting him to subscribe to an online trading platform. Don't even get me started, John, the articles I've been writing about this. Mm-hmm. He invests 700,000 Rand and he loses the money. He loses it all. And then there's a complaint about bad advice. But no, there's no advice.
That's the problem. And look, there's a number of these online trading platforms. There's a number of influencers out there that say you can make an absolute fortune trading in foreign exchange, day trading, all those sort of platforms. And the simple fact is a lot of people register for these things, deposit money into accounts to start trading. There is no intermediary. There is no advice of any kind whatsoever. So if you lose the money, you have been directly trading on this platform. It would be the same as depositing money into your account and withdrawing it. No one else is interacting there. So unfortunately, in those instances, we're unable to assist whatsoever. The warning we just want to put out there, and it's the same with scams, same with Ponzi schemes, and the same with too good to be true investment advertisements. Be careful. Read, research. Just one Google search on is online trading a good idea will herald a absolute plethora of opinions on it, and most of them will warn you this is very high risk and not for the uninitiated or the uneducated. So again, a simple research, simple question can protect you from a lifetime of concern and worry.
And I think also what I want to bring in here, because obviously we're talking about something very specific with the forex trading platforms and people are losing so much money. I think if they're legit platforms, first of all, there's a lot of scams run through them.
Certainly, yeah.
But even the legitimate ones, I think 70% of retail clients lose money on those platforms. Those are the global statistics. So this is when we say high risk, we're talking proper high risk, right? And people always think that they're smart, but you know, 70% of people are getting it wrong on those platforms. But this still also talks to advice and investment performance, because I think it's important that you can't rule against an advisor for bad investment performance unless the performance was guaranteed. You know, it said, we guarantee you. Because if there's a risk, even if they're investing in the stock market, you can't go to your advisor and say, I'm not happy that I only got 2% return over the last 5 years.
Mm. Well, that's certainly an aspect that we look at when it comes to investments. The aspect we primarily focus on is suitability. So we're asking ourselves, when an advisor offers advice on various types of investments, did he record in his record of advice what he suggested, why he suggested it, and why he thinks this particular product or that particular product is best for the client? So that's the only aspect we really assess, is upfront, did the advisor get enough information about the client's needs, recommend suitable products, and did he have a logical basis or a reasonable basis for recommending the product that he did? That's the aspect we basically determine or evaluate. What happens after that is subject to so many market vagaries you cannot predict. We've seen cases where at the time the investment seemed like a really good idea and any reasonable advisor would advise that investment, yet it lost a fortune just a year or two afterwards by international events. That happens. So unfortunately, there would be no basis unless the advisor reasonably should have known this is not a good investment, or there's warnings out there to say, danger, this is not a good investment. There would be no basis to hold the advisor liable for that. So, you know, that's the way we approach it. And certainly, again, from a consumer's point of view, research. You know, the product will be provided, the product name will be provided. Type that name in. Have a look. What does it do? How does it work? Get opinions out there on the internet. You, for yourself, can cover a lot of potential problems that could arise again.
But maybe just not from TikTok is all I'm saying.
Again, yes, within reason.
And also a very important point I want to make, John, is you cannot, you don't have any jurisdiction over non-registered people. So that's the other thing is that you go along and somebody's not registered with the FSCA and they're giving advice. There's nothing the FAS Ombud can do. You can only talk to somebody who is a registered financial advisor.
Yes. Look, it's a highly regulated industry. So basically anyone who gives any financial advice of any kind or sells a financial product must be registered with the FSCA or you cannot do it. It's unlawful, period. So the idea is that anybody who wants financial advice, anybody who wants to buy a financial product, check, are they registered? If they are, by all means, do the usual checks that I've suggested now, Google says and so on, and then you can proceed from there. But the very initial stage is to check whether they're registered. And the problem was is previously, we could look at complaints involving unregistered service providers, but the reality is most of them are scams. Most of them are out to get as much money as they can and then run. So the reality was when we'd send letters to them and say, right, we have a complaint, respond to it, you'd get no response whatsoever. And the problem was we weren't adding anything whatsoever to the investigation of complaints in those regards because most of them were scams. So there's very little we could do. So the Ombud Council imposed with the new rules a rule that says we cannot look at unregistered providers.
Which I think, I think just to sum up, I mean, we've had a really great discussion, but I think to sum up that what has really come through for me very strongly is that, you know, if you are working with an accredited financial advisor, you have protection. You have protection if that advice goes wrong. You have protection knowing that that person hopefully will be sticking to a code of conduct and that there is oversight. And I think you've just heard from John that, you know, the Ombud is there to protect consumers' rights in that. And they're not scared to make some very clear determinations around that. So I want to say thank you very much to you, John. And to our listeners, please make sure that you catch up on all our other conversations with the other various ombuds so that you can understand your rights and where to complain. And remember, the Ombud is a free service. So if you feel that you've been treated unfairly, don't waste your money on a lawyer or even social media, quite frankly. Get in touch with your Ombud because it's for free.